The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This evening, I'm going to start by tracing backward from the world into our own mind. And I'm doing so in a particular way. So you can start by looking at the world, and we see in many ways something of a lack of wisdom. People making choices that are not necessarily for their own welfare, the welfare of others, and the welfare of both. There's a text that says, "A wise person of great wisdom does not intend for their own affliction, for the affliction of others, or for the affliction of both. Rather, when they think only of their own welfare, the welfare of others, the welfare of both, and the welfare of the whole world." But we see that this doesn't always happen. And we might ask, well, why is that? Well, it does take a particular clarity and focus of the mind to be able to see how we can be of actual benefit. How is it that we could act for the welfare of ourselves and others? So we need to have a clear understanding of how things unfold. How do things work? And this requires some stability of our mind in order to do that. But we may not have that. And so then why is that? You know, why don't we have an ongoing stability of mind and clarity about how things work? Well, often this has to do with not paying close attention and not remembering actually what's important to us. And so it takes some continuity of attention to see how things work, which means that we have to remember to pay attention. But of course, you know, this is not easy in a human life. Often we're distracted by our phone, our relationships, our emotions, our self-image, other things that come up. And to be sure, our world right now does not make this easy for us to, you know, to have a clear continuity of attention. But truthfully, it will never be easy. There is no time in the world when everything is simple and easy. So now is as good a time as any. But we don't, you know, we don't have this remembering to pay attention. And then why is that? Well, in many ways, it's just easier to go along, you know, to gather up our energy for a directed purpose, and to be consistent and persistent about that may not be as high on our agenda as just being comfortable or fighting against things or acting out our identity. You know, we have other agendas in our life. And so we don't put together, you know, the energy to kind of gather ourselves toward this purpose of paying attention carefully so that we can act well. And so then why is that? You know, why don't we gather ourselves up? Well, I think there are a number of reasons. You know, maybe we don't think it really matters. Maybe we don't know that paying attention has a good effect, or you know, we may know that external things are still out of our control, but we may not really, you know, believe that it can have that much effect to change the way we are in the world. Or maybe we don't know that real happiness is available through our inner life, through cultivating attention and other such things. Maybe we don't realize that there's any alternative to either fighting or complying with how things are. So what I've done is go backward through a list in Buddhism that's called the five faculties. So starts with the order I went in to go backward was wisdom. You know, we start with, why is it that we're not able to bring benefit to the world, which is one of the definitions of a wise person? Well, we don't have so much concentration. so much stability and clarity of mind. And then why is that? Well, there's not so much mindfulness available to us. And why is that? Well, we don't bring up the energy and the persistence and the consistency to create that mindfulness always. And why don't we bring up that energy? Well, we may not have faith or confidence that it's worthwhile in some way. And so this is a scenario for how, you know, things can unfold in ways that are not so favorable. But the five faculties, this wonderful list of faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, are actually available to us all the time, and they can be used well. We may not think they're available all the time, but these are actually ordinary qualities of mind. The Buddha didn't say that these are special things that come into being through Dharma practice. We all have them to some degree. And the reason that we have them is they're actually the qualities of mind that we use in learning skills. Whenever we're learning something new, which we do throughout our life, we bring to bear some combination of these five. And they're not, that means that they're not automatically spiritual qualities. So we have them, but they may not be connected to our spiritual life. And they become spiritual when they are applied to the task of freeing the mind. So in Buddhism, liberation of the heart is considered the best benefit that we can offer. You know, at the top of that list of wanting to benefit ourselves and others and both, the liberation of the heart is considered the greatest benefit that we can offer. And so suppose that we want to begin acting out of our own benefit for the benefit of others and for the benefit of both. It might take some time to really come into that and cultivate it, but we can. So I want to talk tonight about these five faculties in their spiritual form. So the way that we bring the Dharma to life through our life, if you will, the way that our life itself can enliven the Dharma. And just to let you know in advance, we'll spend most of the time on the first faculty. This is the groundwork from which the rest can unfold, but we'll touch into all of them. So to begin this journey of becoming a real benefit to ourselves and others, we'll start with what in Pali is called Saddha, or faith, or there are other translations also. But before I get to those, this is the idea that there is another way. You know, there is another way to live our life besides just running around and being busy and chasing after pleasures or our identity, other things. So we have this word saddha, this idea of faith. This doesn't mean blind faith, but there is some initial movement towards something that we don't know, some idea or aspiration that we have. Sometimes people use trust, or perhaps later we would use confidence. I'll probably use faith this evening just because it's an easy word to say and because I've come to appreciate it, but I'm aware that for some people that word doesn't work, so you could substitute one of the other ones. This is from Rodney Smith, another teacher. The first moment of our spiritual journey may begin with a glimpse of a possibility that offers relief from all this stress. We hear a talk, read a book, or deeply sense something that suggests there could be a different way to live. This touch calls us from beyond toward a mystery that reprioritizes everything and provides a context for our struggles. This calling does not fit neatly within our conventional lives, but we cannot shake it off. A spark has been ignited, but we are not sure what to do about it. So this is kind of the very initial spark of faith that we might have. And often it's ignited through suffering of some kind. Suffering has a way of pulling aside the veil of our life where we're just going along. You might consider if there's some experience like that that you've had. So Rodney Smith uses this word calling, and this calling, which is a positive response to suffering, I would say is another word for faith. And interestingly, it's also the first glimmer of wisdom, but it needs to be unfolded more before we get to that. The first glimmer of faith is also the first glimmer of wisdom. So then how do we unfold this? How do we go forward from this first spark that we're getting? So there are plenty of external suggestions, if you will, for objects of faith, and they're helpful. Sometimes we need to start with something that comes from the outside or some suggestion from another. In Buddhism, we would usually refer to the initial object of our spiritual faith as the triple refuge or the triple gem of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But we could even talk a bit about these terms. So the suttas talk about faith in the Buddha's enlightenment, not necessarily the person of the Buddha, but we have a sense at a heart level that freedom is possible. And we have some sense that, yeah, somebody really did this. Maybe this is really true. Maybe there's somebody who has done this and knows what they're talking about and describing it or offering instructions for it. And so then we would connect with those instructions, with those teachings. And this is the Dharma, the Dhamma. And we can come to have faith in the process, I guess, of the Dharma. We can't maybe see or even imagine the end point of where we're headed toward, but we trust that it's going in a good direction. So sometimes how I think about faith in the Dharma is, well, I don't necessarily know what this process is going toward, and sometimes it can be a little uncertain or uncomfortable what it is that the Dharma is asking of us, but I do have trust that it goes in a good direction and that it's worth following in that way. So that's the kind of confidence we might have in the Dharma and the quality of the teachings. And then in addition, we can find either a teacher or some mature spiritual friends who are actually embodying the qualities that we respect and value. So we have some kind of a living example of what the teachings are pointing toward, and hopefully some guidance about how we might be able to follow those ourselves. So we also have some trust or confidence in the Sangha. And then I'll mention also that as we're exploring this quality of faith or confidence or trust, there's a connection between faith and joy in the teachings. And so I like to emphasize that we need some kind of positive basis. We can ask ourselves, you know, what might we do each day to nourish joyful faith, this positive sense of aspiration or sometimes even excitement about walking the path. And I think of this as, you know, as I think of this, I'm reminded of a time that I practiced in Sri Lanka for a little while. And I noted that they have a very faith-based practice, maybe more so than we do, definitely more so than we do here in the West, at least in the Insight movement. And I found it quite delightful. I was staying at a monastery, for example, where at a certain time in the morning, the monks would come walking out of the monastery for alms in a neat row, walking together with their bowls mindfully, could see in the way they were walking. And we were at a retreat center, actually, that was just next to the monastery. So we could watch them come out from kind of a position on the walking paths of the retreat center. And when the monks came out, the retreatants would stop walking meditation and just watch. It was kind of a cultural thing that we would just watch quietly while the monks went by. And one day, one of the Sri Lankan yogis turned to me. She spoke English, and she just said with a smile on her face, "It's so nice." You know, and she just meant, you know, being there and watching the monastics go by. So there was kind of this nice feeling that we were celebrating in this faith-based quality of the Dharma, and it nourished our retreat practice for sure. So all of these, ideas or external cues or, reflections that we have or watching monastics are meant to serve actually to strengthen our inner sense of faith. So these outer ideas are actually meant to point toward our inner sense of faith, the actual feeling in our own heart. I have a friend who was doing Tibetan practice, and one of the ways that you begin that is to do, sometimes people begin by doing 100,000 prostrations. So we don't do that in our tradition, but it's, it's something that takes a while to do, of course. And this person found that this discipline of doing lots and lots of prostrations each day and adding them up to make sure he was getting to 100,000 resulted in him being very clear about his deep motivation for undertaking this practice. You have to be connected with that in order to continue all the way through that many prostrations. So he started to realize that was the point of them. It wasn't that he needed to, get his body in shape to be able to do that, although he did. But he realized, what this does is it really instills that inner sense of knowing why you're doing this practice. So this is very healthy, good way to start. But nonetheless, as we go along, this quality of faith will get replaced slowly by knowledge as we have direct experience in the practice. There's a story in the Theravadin teachings of Sariputta, the Buddha's chief disciple, where the Buddha asks him if he has faith that developing the five faculties will lead to awakening. And Sariputta says, no. And he then goes on to explain, though, that he has direct knowledge that developing the faculties leads to awakening. And so he doesn't need to have faith in a statement like that. So there is this understanding that they proceed from faith through the others to wisdom, to knowledge. And, we may want to be careful between, jumping too early to the conclusion that we know something and, maybe instead just deciding that we know something well enough to keep going. But nonetheless, there is this transformation. And then there's also an image that's given in the teachings that says, just as at a crossroads on a level ground, a great banyan tree becomes the resort for birds all around, so the person endowed with faith becomes the resort for many people, monastics and lay followers alike. So then this same sutta says later that people who have this quality of sadha will get more opportunities. So people will ask them to do favors for them, which connects them and gives them the chance to do generosity. And it even says that people with faith in the teachings are more likely to receive teachings. Somehow teachings will come their way because they value them. So the idea here is to consider what the quality of confidence or trust will attract into our lives. This is interesting, right? We're not talking about blind faith at all, but a very clear sense of what we value and placing that at the center of our life as a way of honoring it. And so this is a teaching on causes and conditions. Faith is a quality of the mind or heart that can be cultivated and which has real effects then on how our lives unfold. So if we have faith in the teachings or confidence or trust or conviction, then our practice will unfold differently than for the case of not really having that heart connection well established. So how does this work? In the context of these five faculties, the next one after faith is energy or effort. So when we understand that something is important to us and we have some confidence in it, that it will bring good effects, then we demonstrate that by acting upon it, if you will. So this second faculty of effort is often equated with perseverance, sticking with the practice, having some continuity. And that takes some energy, since the mind might not be used to devoting itself to the Dharma or to practice in this regular way. And I find that these middle three of effort, mindfulness, and concentration kind of form a set that play off of each other. Doing things plays off with paying attention, and they mutually reinforce each other in kind of a virtuous circle, if you will. There's a little bit of an iteration that goes on where, you know, we put in effort initially, but then we have to pay attention to the effects of how we're practicing and how our effort is working out. And then we, through that, we realize that we might need to make effort slightly differently, or we might need to change it over time. And then we again pay attention to that. And over time, we have a gathering of the mind around the effort that it's making, the attention that it has, the intention behind the aspiration that we're carrying. So concentration is slowly developing, the gathering of the mind. And all the while, the mind is letting go of things that are not useful for its effort. And so the perspective it has and the playing field, if you will, keep changing. So I think I don't want to present the five faculties as just a linear chain that we have to do one and then the next and then the next. It's more that they really begin to mutually reinforce over time. So when the attention and the effort are getting harmonized, we can feel the mind settle into this more unified state, as if all the disparate components of it get aligned. It's a state of high energy and high attention at the same time. So this is this fourth quality of samadhi, concentration as the fourth faculty. So in life, samadhi can feel like sometimes what's called flow. We know what we're doing, our energy is well directed and without tension, and there's a stability such that we can't easily get knocked off course. So this, when the mind is in a state like that, is when we get to experiential learning, and that becomes integrated into our system, which is also what wisdom is about. So when we're kind of able to manifest what we originally had faith in, so this is wisdom, being able to act with benefit for ourselves, others, and both. Somewhat paradoxically, although there was a lot of setup to get to this point of being able to manifest what it is that we were first valuing, the state actually feels quite natural. So we start to get a sense of the Dharma as a way of life. We had to do all this setup just to be natural, if you will. So I want to kind of bring things together at this point. We often talk about the Dharma as if it's a fixed thing. But in its most basic definition, Dharma actually just means nature. So the Dharma arises in our life in the way that we evoke it. And part of the art of Dharma practice is to learn how to be natural. So we mostly prevent ourselves from being natural. We need to stop doing the things that are getting in the way of being natural and being in line with the Dharma. And cultivating the five faculties is one way to get into this alignment, so that there are sort of supportive dharmic forces carrying our life along. I'm relating this now to an image from an essay that Gill wrote, and I like it because it talks about needing a skill. Remember that the five faculties come into play whenever we're learning a skill. So he writes, "The way the Dharma arises can be compared to floating in fresh water. Floating is a learned skill that depends on our having both the intention to float and the skill. When we float, we may say that the water supports us, but in fact, the water alone is not sufficient to keep us from drowning. If we don't know how to float and we thrash around in fear or only relax and trust, the water won't hold us up. So the dynamic interplay of the water and our body and our intention and skill creates the floating." So then he analogizes this to the Dharma. As a support for our lives, the Dharma is like the floating. the Dharma is not found simply by letting go any more than floating safely in water simply requires relaxing. There are certain skills and intentions that need to be present for the Dharma to appear and to function. And it's through the way that we live that the Dharma can have a role in our lives. I like that a lot. And I picked it out in particular because this floating image, I think with some not too much effort, you can pull out all the five faculties from that short reading I did. So we do have to relax and trust. We're not thrashing around in the water. But this isn't the only thing. We don't stop with faith. We go on to make some kind of intentional effort. So having some energy in our ability to float or to bring the Dharma into our life. And we'll need to be paying attention as we do that to our body and the water and how the floating is working. And then we'll need to balance all the different factors, the dynamic interplay of the water, our body, and our intention. All of that means that we're gathering ourselves around this idea of floating. And so we have the concentration factor. And then through all of this, we come into a genuine experiential knowledge of how to float. So it becomes easy. And then similarly, we can gain this intuitive knowing of when and how to do things in order to float on the support of the Dharma. So we'll end by going back through the five faculties in our life. So as we begin to trust in approaching life in a different way than we do when we're just busy and scrambling around, we have some trust that there's another way, then we will start to make effort that's more harmonious, that's less about just getting what is pleasant and getting rid of what is unpleasant, and more about developing what is wholesome and renouncing what is unwholesome. Those are very different kinds of effort. So we move toward this cultivation of the wholesome. And then it's natural that we'll be more attentive. You know, we have to watch and remember to stay present in order to keep our mind and body in a good state. And then as we do that, we will see more and more clearly and we'll feel more and more aligned and stable in our heart. And as we have that stability of attention, we'll be able to see how it is that we can actually be of benefit, how it is that our life can be more aligned, more harmonious with the values that we have. And the fruition of that is that we will be of benefit to ourselves, others, both, and the whole world. So we will come to embody wisdom. So these five faculties really do lead to a harmonious and balanced life. And when they're applied to the Dharma, they can also lead to liberation. We can come to maybe at least have faith in that. And I hope that someday we will all know that for sure. So it's not maybe so easy as I laid it out in that nice arrangement. And yet it is kind of easy, you know, kind of like floating. Not so easy, but pretty easy when we get into it. So these are my thoughts for this evening on the five faculties and life. And I wish you all very well in your ongoing cultivation of each and all of them. Thank you. Be well.